one of those young people a seatbelt. And in the opinion of the state police, they would have been bruised, maybe battered a little, but certainly not killed if they had their seatbelt. Well, that just, you know, you just get data like that over and over and over again. But there's still a lot of people who are too rushed to hook up or too inconvenienced when you refer to the police. Messes up the lady's
justice. It's a big argument in my house, though.
She said, I don't know about the
rightfully true stuff. I said, I have to say something, but that doesn't go anywhere.
No, I tell you, they're impervious to even subtle coercion on that point. My mother and dad, same way. Older people, they're just as bad as women in general. When I go and visit my folks, I refuse to move out till they hook up. I say, okay, you either hook up while I'm driving you, or we don't go. You got a choice. Everybody's got a choice. I have to do that, or my mother and dad won't hook up. So,
Mr. Woods finds us $5. He catches you.
You know, you got to have some.
He's crazy.
He's the same way about smoking. He'll let anybody smoke anywhere in the building.
Well, we are gradually applying the clamps on that. Finally, now that DOD's have the intestinal fortitude to issue some policies.
Okay. There's a bunch of men standing right out behind the TV station with the sunshine on going. Good luck, it's all. They don't smoke inside.
They're almost like the young people out the back fence of the high school.
Right. They don't smoke in that building, though.
He didn't swim out of that, too?
Yeah, he's had that.
Ooh. He let him drink on the job, though, wouldn't he?
Don't care about that. Don't light no cigarette up, I can tell you that.
Shoot, that boy Ray up here. This has been an interesting... I wasn't talking. I wasn't making my opening remarks. No, I would just be.
You're going to lose time.
But I think that led by the Begin-Sadat dialogue, I think it's been an interesting period from a newsworthy point of view. In fact, without that dialogue, as far as world events are concerned, in recent weeks, I can't think of anything that of that significance.
Is it Time magazine that came out this week with Sadat as man of the year?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I'm not a bit surprised.
Good morning. Because
this initiative is certainly noteworthy.
Did you see what was the top news story of the year, though? Mm-hmm. Last year's call.
Oh, what?
Did you see what was fourth or fifth?
Elvis is dead. Still.
Well, you know, we haven't fully recovered from that whole winter last year yet.
Your roads probably take years to get your roads back.
Well, I guess I should say the dollar impact of that cold snap. That coupled with the fact that our power rate can be increased without full warning, makes anybody operate on the basis of a budgeted program very difficult to impossible.
So that's Betty Groom from the Enterprise Ledger.
Hi. Sorry, I'm in an uncomfortable position.
How are you? Betty
Groom.
Groom. Oh, I see. Groom. Just like Groom.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever met everybody in the meeting. Right? Every time we have a get together, I meet someone new, and maybe just turn over.
Probably
turn
over.
Tell me, Betty, how long have you been with the Ledger?
About 5 months.
5 months, okay. And you?
About 5 months.
5 months.
Eight.
I've been back to work for about 2 months.
Oh, 2 months. You've gone and come back since
right.
I talked to you.
That's right.
worked over in Columbus, Georgia.
You've been here forever.
22 years in the Army and 3 years at Channel 4 and 4.5 years at the IRB.
Jerry, how long have you been here?
Starting 20 years.
Is that right? Well, you are the senior emeritus media type.
There's a couple at the Eagle, Mr. Driggers and Tex, in this area probably longer than I have.
Mm-hmm. Get you a gold watch.
Yeah.
See, I started covering things here at Fort Worth in 1955. I was GCID here at Fort Worth.
Oh, I see. That's where you got your investigative psychological approaches.
Now that was 3 years of counterintelligence. He claims he still knows a bunch of stuff.
Waiting for the right time to share
it. He makes a bunch of guys squirm over the bar all the time. I see him doing that.
Oh, I see.
We can begin at your
convenience. Ready, huh?
Yes, sir.
Well, I thought we'd use the same format that we had with the chief, and that is I'd make a few remarks and then let you all ask questions. I've learned through the years that oftentimes more important information comes out in response to questions because those are the things that people are interested in. I'm now over 17 months at Fort Rucker, and since we're nearing the end of the calendar year, and some of us at least like to look toward New Year's resolutions, I've been in a sort of a reflective mood in the last few days, and that fortunately coincides with having an opportunity to meet with the media of the Wiregrass and update what's going on at Fort Rucker and some of the things we can look forward to in the new calendar year. I think that if we look back over 1977 at Fort Rucker, we talk about two very closely related aspects of our life here. One has to do with the rather significant reorientation of our aviation training. To cope with the requirements of the modern battlefield, which of course is based primarily on the Soviet threat and the European environment. The influence of that environment on our tactics and techniques in aviation employment has been significant when one compares how we fought the war aviation-wise in Vietnam as compared to how we feel we must do it if we go to war in the future in Europe. Well, that influence has permeated every evaluated process at the Aviation Center related to aviation training, how we should train our young people to cope with those conditions that we expect to see in a future war if we unfortunately have to fight it. That's one part of this dual effort that's been underway in 77 at Fort Rucker. The other is a direct result of it, and that is all the personnel impact. And since we consider ourselves people-oriented here, you can bet that a large part of my time has been involved in personnel matters. Personnel matters that relate to, more importantly than military changes, those that affect our civilian workforce, both our civil service
workforce and our contractor workforce. This becomes a almost daily matter, especially if you will refer back to one of the points made by our chief of staff, General Rogers, when he was here, to wit that Fort Rucker may be more than the average post in the Army. It's very heavily involved in contractor operations. And whenever we have a large contracting effort, then associated personnel actions, such as reductions in force, are very important matters. And they affect everybody on post, including the military, who have to sort of pick up the slack every time we have to make an adjustment downward in our civilian workforce, either contractor or civil service. And when I think about 1977, those are the two most significant parts of our life. As we project towards 1978, we see a continuing series of adjustments related to both of those 1977 issues. We are continuing to refine our organization for training as we learn more about our revised initial entry rotary wing course, which is our primary course of flight training. As we learn to do that particular course better, we find ourselves fine-tuning the organizational structure. Anytime you make any effort with regard to the organizational structure, then you have related personnel actions. For example, we are in the process right now of studying the application to Fort Rucker of our directed guidance for 1978 for reduction in force. Interestingly, our guidance now for any reduction for 1978 states that first guideline, such a reduction will be done through attrition and will not involuntarily force individuals, as we say it, out the gate. In other words, persons will not be released as a function of a directed reduction in the spaces which will be authorized to me and to Fort Rucker. This means that whatever space I determine will be one of those to be reduced from our structure, if it contains a person, then that person must be reassigned within the workforce. And of course, that reassignment has to be done in accordance with civil service regulations. In every detail, down to including what I call the last resort, which would be to retrain a person if there is no opportunity within the foreseeable months to find a position in which that person is already trained. I think this is important to the community because you can see that at least we have finally convinced the entire hierarchy in the Defense Department, up to including the President, that our people are our most important part of our effort, and that it should be a last resort when we ask someone to leave our workforce involuntarily. So we will take spaces that are vacant. We will delete some of them where appropriate. We will be able to hire very few people. Obviously, if by attrition you're going to go down in strength, it does have an ultimate effect on the community, one of reducing to the bare minimum the number of people who will be hired during 78. And the two plus retirements will comprise the majority of the attrition that we will experience in 1978 for Rutgers. Now, that's going to be the name of the game here in 78, and that is one of reducing assets, both dollars and people, which makes the ongoing effort more challenging as time moves by. We all at Fort Rucker have to become more capable in our job if we're going to continue to perform our primary missions without any reduction in standards. So when I have an opportunity to talk to the civilian workforce, I encourage them to continue their outstanding performance as part of the total team. And I emphasize to them that they are in every way just as important to me as a person in uniform, because they're occupying one space which I'm allocated to do the jobs we have to do it for them. And there isn't anything that I can say in my whole tour here that I feel more strongly than that. And that is that every person is equally important. One of the highlights of calendar year 78 will be that we will see the arrival late in the year of our Black Hawk helicopter, our newly produced utility helicopter, Black Hawk, the UH-60. Starting in July 78, we will start sending our maintenance personnel to the Sikorsky Aircraft Plant for initial maintenance training. And then in November and December, we will receive three aircraft of the first 15 to be produced. We will initiate pilot training. The early training will be instructor pilots. Obviously, those who will then teach follow-on qualification and instructor pilot courses. And we will very slowly build up the number of Black Hawk helicopters here until about 1985-86. We probably have approximately 50 of the Black Hawk helicopters before that. That total program, by the way, at the moment, provides for about 1,100 helicopters, Black Hawks, to come into the Army inventory. That ship will be primarily oriented on replacing certain numbers of our Huey fleet, not all, but we've got lots of Hueys in the Army. Those will go, the new ones will go in priority to units such as 6th Air Cavalry Combat Brigade, 101st Airborne Division, Air Cavalry Units, Air Ambulance Units, with some emphasis on priority that would go to Europe, which has really the highest priority of most units in the Army. So that's going to be sort of one of the highlights of 78, the arrival of our newest developed helicopter into the inventory. other than that, our training will continue generally as it has in 77, with a couple exceptions. We will train more pilots in 78, roughly 100 more. And that results from an increase in the number of commissioned pilots that we'll be training. We will have a more significant increase in the number of enlisted personnel in our air traffic control, aircraft mechanic, and operations specialist courses. We will be increasing about 2,500 students in output, 77 enlisted students. I foresee that another continuing issue in 78 will be our gradually reducing medical support. We have discussed this several times before, and it certainly has been in the press, explaining the impact of the reduction of doctors in our Lister Army Hospital. So that's not new. But as we begin to lose the doctors after the first of the year, obviously there will be more people becoming personally involved in the reduced medical support available. That is available at the Army Hospital. The Lister Hospital staff and I are working regularly with the Health Services Command, headquartered in Fort Sam Houston, attempting to, shall we say, reduce the impact of that shortage in every possible way. Typical of the kind of relief that will be forthcoming is that we recently got authority to hire 3 civilian doctors to augment our military staff. And we're in that process of evaluating applications that have been received to determine the most capable, competent, proficient doctors we can to fill those 3 positions. The medical staff continues to work on various methods of contracting out various requirements, such as radiology. We don't foresee that we are going to get a radiologist as a replacement, so it's obvious that that is one service that will have to be contracted somewhere in the local environment. There are other specialties that will likewise not have a doctor. These specialties will either be contracted where appropriate, for example, any medical support required for our military women in the OBGYN area will be a combination of referring these patients to Fort Benning and Fort Gordon or other military facilities, or some sort of contracting to get whatever support is required. For dependent and other type medical support, referrals to Champus will be increasing gradually after the first of the year. Where appropriate, of course, in special cases, dependents and other type categories other than active Army will also be referred to other military medical facilities when that appears to be the best avenue to go. But that's going to be a constant matter for our attention as the months go into 78. As the Chief of Staff of the Army said to you recently when he visited Fort Rucker, the outlook is not bright, but with the various actions being taken by the Army Medical Corps to soften the reduction, we are, at least in my mind, we are hoping that we can take appropriate actions that will somewhat reduce the impact on our people. There is no everybody is going to be at least more inconvenienced than they have in the past. I have covered what I think are going to be the major items, and I'd like to reserve the question and answers the more specific matters that you might be interested in.
There's been a lot of information put out recently, and you appeal to the mayor to help you explain the reason for night flying. I think we don't need to go into that because we all understand the need for night flying. It's just been saturated lately with the explanations of it. Have you been getting a lot of feedback from the general public? But is that why you're appealing to the mayor to help?
We have received a number of written complaints and a number of telephone complaints about our night flying. I can say that most of the complaining has, I think, originated from the Ozark area because of our night flying training at Hooper Stage View. Well, you could say that, well, when you consider the number of people who live in the community, the few complaints we've gotten are certainly not significant. Well, as you know, when we get one complaint that has to do with our flight training, we respond to that because we as aviators and in aviation training have always been working with people in the wiregrass trying to make sure that we integrate our flight training requirements with acceptable degree of people. I have asked the mayors to become involved because part of the education regarding the reasons for our having to do this training, I think they can do maybe better than we. I should be honest and state that a number of the complaints have come from retired military. And one might think that they would be the last ones to have to be told why we've got to train differently than we have in the past. But notwithstanding that, a number of our complaints have been from retired military. Naturally, people off post are concerned about the value of their property as it relates to noise. And if a person is trying to sell his house, he may be very personally concerned about noise at night, flying helicopters. If he's in the real estate business, he obviously is concerned because he needs to at least make his potential customers aware of such activities. So there is a wide cross-section of reasons why people need to know the basis for our night flying. Now, once we reach a certain peak of our night flying effort, then there will no longer be an increase. That means then that once the revised course of instruction is really underway, then the same number of students, generally speaking, same number of aircraft are undergoing night training during any one period. And we're doing things to try and reduce the impact on the local area. We've got construction underway to increase the number of stage fields at which we can do night flights. That'll give us more flexibility, and it certainly will reduce saturating one stage over others. You see, to date, in years past, since we did not do very much night flying, we had not prepared very many stage fields for night operation. Well, we're now having to install lighting and those things that are required for night operation support. And as time goes by, we will get more of those stage fields fully operational and within the limits of the funds available for that, we'll be able to reduce the impact. That's especially going to affect Hooper because Hooper is one of the few that we've had available for night, and that's where we've been doing the night training. After we get a couple more stage fields to the south prepared, that'll reduce the impact, but not eliminate the pipeline.
You know, I may be ignorant of this because I've been waiting so long. The sheet was passed out to us, number 6 and 7 here. Speaking of Southern Airlines service and closing or rerouting of Highway 27, just for my benefit, maybe everybody else already knows, but what exactly is that?
Well, of course, two different subjects. I think it's fair to say that the Wiregrass has generally been unhappy with airline support out of Dothan ever since Eastern was withdrawn as one of the supporting airlines out of Dothan Airport. And that's some 15 years ago. As the area has continued to develop, this has put more and more pressure on Southern Airways support out of Dothan. And in fact, it was one of the subjects that I was confronted with when I got here 17 months ago. I found that we had problems regarding scheduling, passenger capacity, and all of those things that relate to airline support. We started working with Southern Airways months ago to improve airline support out of Wiregrass. The mayors and I have been working together on this right along. After we had a meeting with President Hall of Southern Airways at the Chamber of Commerce in Dothan, all of us mayors, President Hall stated then that they would go back with our proposals and see what they could do to improve support. Well, they did improve the scheduling, but there were several areas in which they did not make any changes. And it's in those areas that the current unhappiness is based. One of them is that the first morning flight from Dothan to Atlanta departs too late to make proper connections with flights out of Atlanta to various places in the country. One of the changes that was made after our meeting in Dothan several months ago was to delay that flight out of Atlanta to Dothan, and thus the return to Atlanta was later. Another unhappiness is that there is no direct connection between Dothan and Birmingham. As the Dothan area industrially continues to grow, there appears to be a greater demand for people to get to Birmingham. Well, there's no direct connection. A person either has to drive it or go through Atlanta to get to Birmingham. Well, I think there's one kind of flight to go from Montgomery to Birmingham, but that's not so insignificant. So there is no direct connection. Now, part of the unhappiness comes from the fact that there is at least one southern flight that comes from south of us out of Florida, overflies Dothan, and goes to Birmingham. So, you know, in the perception of us Wiregrass types, it appears to be somewhat reasonable to ask for a stopover in Dothan to pick up whoever wants to go to Birmingham. Well, it's not that easy. Southern Airways has a 28 aircraft fleet, and the demands on it are growing, and there is less flexibility all the time in that fleet. If one aircraft is 30 minutes late on any leg of any flight, that delay will be perpetuated at least until they stop flying that night with all of the connecting flights for that aircraft. It just perpetuates itself right into the night. And if it gets involved with crew rest, it can affect the next morning. Initiation of operation. I'm getting a little bit technical, but I've been so involved in this effort that I've had to become more knowledgeable of the problems that Southern has in meeting our requirements. We continue to work on it. I had a meeting yesterday of a representative from Southern. Again, outlining's not correct, detailing what are the unhappiness conditions, as I know them to be. We continue to work with Southern, hoping that they will improve.
Is there any chance of getting Delta or Eastern into the...
I can't answer that question. That is, I guess you could say, a last resort. That is one of the thoughts by many individuals in the wireless. That is the way to solve the problem, is to get competition, more service, if you will, by another airline out of Dover. Well, I say it's the last resort only because before you can get another airline in and out of Dover, then the Civil Aeronautics Board has to get involved. And that, being a Washington-level agency, is going to be very, very involved. And even after you might have it all worked out as far as what we think we ought to have, and an airline might want to do it, getting approval from the president, which is also involved in that, is a matter of conjecture. So it's one of those possibilities, but I say it's the last resort. There are other earlier opportunities. Southern acquiring more aircraft and more crews is an example of something that the current servicing airline has to study with a view towards meeting what the demands of the area. Statistically, Southern can show that they're supporting us, that they don't need more aircraft, more crew. And they use all of the various factors that are common in airline service to prove that point. That doesn't allay the unhappiness of individuals in the wiregrass, and that's the reason why we have to continue to work with them until we can convince them that they must improve the service. Their statistics not the same. There's another unhappiness area, and that is that when they made the changes to the schedule, it eliminated the connecting flight to New Orleans, which makes at least a few people in the wiregrass unhappy who had those requirements to go to New Orleans, and they don't like having to go to Atlanta to catch an airplane to go to New Orleans. So those are the unhappiness areas. The early morning flight to Atlanta, the Birmingham direct connection, and access to New Orleans to the south without having to go through Atlanta. And we continue to work on these things with Southern.
And what was the subject to in the closing rerouting of Highway 27 to Philadelphia?
All right. As we continue to prepare ourselves for that battlefield of a future war, especially in aerial gunnery, we find ourselves with increasing requirements for greater range in our impact area on the reservation. Well, as you might know, Highway 27 between Ozark and Enterprise essentially bisects our reservation. And to date, our impact area is north of Highway 27. Well, that means that the other half of our reservation has not been used in the past for shooting. That is, other than small arms, small caliber weapons. Well, coming on now in development is our Hellfire missile, which will be the primary armament, anti-tank armament, for the AH-64, which is our advanced attack helicopter, which is also coming down developmental line. We have to be able to fire the Hellfire at Fort Rucker. We cannot do that with the current impact area, which is north of Highway 27. So we have initiated actions. We have briefed all the mayors, county commissioners, state highway department officials, all of those directly concerned with such a closing. And then we're sort of on a countdown so that as the new weapons requirements confront us, we will have to initially close out Highway 27 on a part-time basis and then ultimately close it off completely. And at that time, of course, there would have to be, for either one of these conditions, there would have to be rerouting of those who want to travel from Ozark to Enterprise or vice versa. And of course, we do have alternate routes, a couple of which we suggested in our briefings to the various officials in the local area. And of course, there are certain planning actions underway between local officials and the state's highway authorities about what they would do in the long range for a primary bypass.
Are you satisfied that the growth of Fort Brooke will continue about the same in years to come, or do you think it? What's your opinion on this?
Well, I'll take it in segments in order to properly answer that question. Our long-range program, which is usually a five-year program, shows that there will be a gradual increase of commissioned officer pilot training at Fort Rucker from its present level, which for 1978 is, I'll say, roughly 200 commissioned officers, and ultimately level off at about 450. Now, how soon we will reach that point is a function of dollars and all other assets, and of course, a continuation of the program as evaluated right now. But, so if you just sort of draw a straight line from 200 to 450 with even 100 a year, you can see that it'll take 2 or 3 years, and that kind of an impact on Fort Rucker may not be called significant. I think that we're going to find a leveling off of our enlisted student training, because remember I said that from 77 to 78 we're going up 2,500, which is a rather significant increase in enlisted specialist training. But I think that'll level off. The other training changes will be somewhat what we call modifications. For example, I pointed out we were going to do some instructor pilot training in the Black Hawk, the new utility helicopter. Well, there'll be a reduction to some degree in instructor pilot training in other aircraft, specifically the Huey, because the units are going to be replacing out the old aircraft with the new. I think that a person who would back off and look at Fort Rucker in general would say that roughly we're going to stay about the same in total strength who are permanently assigned and roughly level off in student training. In other words, I see nothing on the horizon right now that's going to make a significant impact in the number of people being trained, unless you consider 100 commissioned officers a significant impact in 1 year's time. If you divide them over 25 classes, which is what we teach, you can see that you're not talking about a significant increase in load. Now, if you talk about possibilities, I have to mention, being candid about this, that there's always looming off as a possibility, Navy-Marine consolidation, training consolidation at Fort Rucker. And we don't have any ongoing action right now to prepare for that because, as the Chief of Staff of the Army told you all a few weeks ago, that wasn't an Army initiative to begin with. OSD initiative to combine the training, all the helicopter pilot training of the services here. The Congress has disapproved it 2 straight years. So what happens in the future is up to somebody else other than U.S. Army authorities. We obviously have to keep our data updated regarding that issue so that we can respond at any time somebody wants us to take another look at it. But we have nothing active in the way of an action that relates to transferring Navy Marine helicopter pilot training from Pensacola here. That would be a significant change. That's why I mention it as only a possible action that would probably be the only thing that would make a significant change in our strategy or our effort.
If you wave some sort of magical wand, what would be the most significant achievement that you would like personally to see here for Fort Rucker in 1970? Would it be the consolidation of Navy training, the restoration of some of your personnel spaces that you've lost, or what would it be?
We have had 17 months of work with our higher headquarters attempting to improve their understanding of the dollar cost related to aviation training. We happen to be the most expensive training base in TRADOC, Training and Doctrine Command. So we're constantly targeted for reductions because we are the most expensive. Aviation training is expensive and there's no question about it. It's our job here at Fort Rucker to educate the people above us as to why it's expensive and why we are doing as much as we can do to manage our assets in the best possible way. Now, if both Training and Doctrine Command headquarters and Department of Army headquarters were to say in unison to me, we now understand, if they were to do that in 78, I would consider that the most significant accomplishment, managerially speaking, of my tour here. Because I happen to know that this is not a new problem. Fort Rucker's had a problem forever trying to explain to the people on top why it is that aviation is costly, what the impact is. And this was reflected. I still don't have my contract with my higher headquarters for the operation of 1978 fiscal year. And it's by that contract that I'm given people, missions, money to do whatever has to be done. And that fiscal year started 1 October. Passed. The reason why General Starry and I haven't signed a contract is because we've been in an almost daily process, his staff and mine, he and I, trying to come to an understanding of what I require in 78 to operate this installation. We think we're pretty close to an understanding now, but we're not there. We started with a $31 million disconnect, and that is significant. When your higher commander thinks that the lower commander can do a job with $31 million less than the lower commander knows he's got to have, then you've got a problem of articulation, and that's what we've been going through for weeks. We're pretty close now to an agreement. And I hope that within the next 3 or 4 weeks that we can resolve that and we can both sign a contract that says, this is what I'm going to get for 78. Now you could say, well, that doesn't seem to be very personal in nature, you know, but it affects everything we do here, starting with our people. Because I have a lot of people who are paid with money that I get from the higher headquarters. Non-appropriated funds, for example, relate very closely to what I get in the appropriated fund side of the budget. How many people I hire on non-appropriated side is a function of how much money I've got to pay appropriated personnel. So all of these ramifications are involved.
How soon do you expect to have something worked out and know what kind of budget you're going to have to work with?
Well, as I said, I hope in a few weeks to have that. The delay right now is the fact that Training and Doctrine Command and I are closely in agreement, and now we're trying to get the Department of the Army to agree. And, of course, the funds, you know, they start from Department of the Army level, so all three of us have got to see this very clearly, right down to the dollar, before the JDOC commander and I can sign this. Because he's dependent upon money from the Department of the Army to resolve some of his problems, too.
So you may have to do the same process you went through the JDOC commander through the Department of Army.
We've been in that process concurrently with these other actions with our training and doctrine command. But it takes a couple more actions with DA before. Well, for example, you see, Fort Rucker's costs, generally speaking, are based on the flying hours. We're aviation training. The costly part of our training is the flying hour. All right. So if they tell me that I'm not going to get as much money as I need to put through the students they told me I'm going to have, then I have no alternative but to say to my bosses, then you must reduce the student input. Because unless I reduce the number of flight hours, then I can't reduce my costs. Well, as soon as that's said, from me to TRADOC, DA, Department of the Army, is involved because they're the ones that program the students. The student flow is programmed at Department of the Army. TRADOC and I execute that plan, that program. And that's where we are right now, is determining what courses of instruction or what classes will either be reduced or eliminated, or how many students in any one class will be reduced, so that they can bring my cost down to what they say they're going to give me in the way of funds. It's that simple, but very complicated.
So you do stand to lose some students, military?
Military, yes.
Five students here.
But again,
$31 million worth of
instruction. Well, no. We're down now to where we're talking about 8 to 10 million that we've got to find in some way of rebudgeting in order to come to a...
The biggest chunk of that would come out of instruction costs?
Flight hours. Flying hours. Because that's where most of our costs are. You see, my civilian flight contractor, he is paid based on the number of flight hours he teaches. That's a big cost. The civilian maintenance contractor on the aircraft, his costs are essentially a result of the flying hours we put on the aircraft. So you can see why the flight hour is the key. We have probably the largest service contract in the Army here in our aircraft maintenance contract, about $29 million. Well, that's all a function of the flight hours on the aircraft. You don't fly them, you don't have to maintain them anywhere near as much, you see. And that's where the costs are. So if they want to make a significant reduction in the money they want to give me, we've got to reduce flight hours. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions?
It's sort of a summary of what you said. The Army is quite different in its overall operation than what it was in past years. An installation commander now is, in every sense of the word, a manager. Although we're not a profit-making organization, we obviously have to be cost-effective in everything we do. Because there isn't any agency of the United States government that is scrutinized more in depth and breadth than the Defense Department. I sometimes personally, as a taxpayer, wish they were looking as closely at you. I think HEW and the in the tremendous escalation in that budget bears some scrutiny. But notwithstanding that, we get it in the Defense Department, and that means that we've got to be more and more effective at using our tax dollars in the best possible way. That's why I think that almost any installation commander you talk to in the Army today, at least, uppermost in his mind is going to be this business of balancing out missions, people, dollars. In the best possible way. Our $230 million budget here sounds rather significant. But interestingly, only about 5 to 7% of that, do I have any flexibility? In other words, most of that is what I would call as almost fixed cost. People, for example. You got to pay your people. That takes a large chunk out of that $230 million. Once you contract with somebody, that's a fixed cost, generally, except the sliding scale I inferred from the flight hours. But most of what we do here is fixed, at least to the flight hour. And I wind up with about 5 to 7% of that where I have some flexibility where I can say, well, if we run short, I'll move it from here to here. Well, that's only a very small part of that $230 million that I can do that. That makes it challenging.
I do have one final question. I want to reverse the question and ask you about waving your magical wand for 78. What do you consider in 77, from your standpoint as a commander, the most significant single achievement in your program?
Single achievement?
Or adverse thing?
Well, I think that the most significant things we've done for Army Aviation, as it relates to Fort Rucker, have been the new courses of instruction. And I'll just quickly sum them up. Never throughout the entire history of Army Aviation, prior to this year, 77, did we have a refresher training course at Fort Rucker. Now that is important because in the past, the units in the field had to take people who'd been off flying from 3 to 5 years, maybe more, and get them requalified as aviators. Well, for the first time in the Army history, we're doing at least 500 of those a year. That, to me, is significant. The revised course of instruction, for the first time, qualifies an Army aviator in night operations. In the past, we flew night hours at Rucker, but we didn't have a comprehensive night qualification phase. We do now. These are the key things that I consider most significant, because see, they have an impact on the Army forever, as long as you've got these young people in the service, people who are going to be training in this revised course. Since our mission is essentially aviation training, that's why I'm not talking to you. I don't have, in my mind, anything that's made me continuously unhappy, so I haven't had any adverse action that I've seen that lingers in my mind. They're just what I call normal daily challenges. And I can say, though, in quick summary, that I sure enjoyed 17 months of venture. I hope I'm going to have more. As far as I know, I will have more because I don't have any indication that I'm not going to be here for 17 more. Further, the opponent saith not.
Appreciate your time, gentlemen.
Thank you, Matt. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm good.
I think you just ought to pass a sales tax or something out of here. Can you do that?
Pass a sales tax. How do you mean?
That's what they do in the, at least around in the civilian life.
Oh.
They just put a sales tax on something.
Yeah, well. We don't have that kind of flexibility, unfortunately. I must admit, though, that in a way, some of our military people would say that we have done that. You know, we are now charging fees at many of our rec services facilities, which is something that's new in the Army. We didn't do that through the years, but now that pay comparability has been achieved, I put that in quotes, there are those who feel that the fee operation is a logical thing to come. So in effect, we put a tax on certain of our rec service facilities.
It may be a good news story, though, if we just come up with a good sales tax.
Well, I was going to suggest him to convert his physical fitness center into a courthouse and lease it to Coffee County.
I like that, brother.
You mean you need another one?
They don't know what to do with the food they got. Well, that's a big controversy.
Well, you know, I've been watching Senator Miller and his points, and I'm glad to see that there seems to be a consensus building towards a referendum, at least. And I think that's, you know, there isn't any way to help reduce the level of volatility on any issue than letting people step up and take a cut at that ball. I might add, it tends to have a lot of people refuse to step up and take a cut. But the only way to sort of pierce the pressure on an issue that exists in the community is give them access, an outlet.
Is there if we quote you on that, General?
No, it's just a considerable pressure he wants to represent.